Win stacks of cash by entering the 150K Crack the Code giveaway, brought to you by your local paper, now through July 14th. Look for the code on page A2. Then visit 150kgiveaway.com and submit your entry. You could win the grand prize of $100,000. Grab the paper every day. Get the code on page 2A and improve your chances to win tons of weekly cash prizes. Visit 150kgiveaway.com for details.
It was one of the most perplexing stories, I think, in the region at the time. There, you know, this is a time where there was a lot of weird stuff going on in Central Florida and Volusia County in particular. But these two in particular, you know, Josh and Lillian, I think because of their age and the nature of their vanishing, it gained a lot of attention from the police, from the community, from outside folks looking in.
That was Alicia Caldwell, who 15 years ago was a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. She talked to me about the unusual case of Lillian Martin and her grandson, Joshua Bryant, both of whom vanished without a trace from their Deltona home one morning in the spring of 2001. That case remained unsolved for 3 years, until a man with a violent streak went on a rampage that resulted in 3 murders, 2 kidnappings, a police chase, and a suicide. That story is coming up on Sun Crime State. I'm Tony Holt, crime reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Welcome to Sun Crime State, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at some of Florida's biggest crime stories of the past and present. In this episode, I'll discuss the slayings of Lillian Martin and her 10-year-old grandson, Joshua Bryant, who were removed from their home the morning of May 12, 2001. Joshua's remains were found 15 years ago in the Casadega area, a small community about 4 miles north of Deltona. Lillian's body was never found, but investigators determined that the man who killed both Lillian and Joshua was Douglas McClymont, a drug-addled felon from DeLand who was responsible for a total of 4 murders and may be a person of interest in another. My special guest for that segment will be Wall Street Journal reporter and former Orlando Sentinel reporter Alicia Caldwell, along with Daytona Beach News Journal editor Mark Harper and Volusia County Sheriff Sergeant A.J. Paglieri. But first, I'll discuss a rape case out of Flagler County involving a Winter Park area developer who was accused of drugging 2 women and sexually battering one of them inside his beachside home.
It's a very quiet beachside community. You know, it seems like half the houses are right on the beach, and the rest of those houses are basically within walking distance of the beach. So, you know, it's definitely not the type of place that you would drive through and think that things like this might be going on.
That was Corporal George Ristakopoulos of the Flagler County Sheriff's Office describing Beverly Beach, a small town of about 400 people, comfortably nestled between a river to the west and an ocean to the east. Beverly Beach is rarely the scene of any crime activity, but early this month, the sheriff's office arrested a resident there on accusations he drugged and sexually battered a woman in his home in late 2017. Larry Cavallaro, a 72-year-old Central Florida developer, was eventually booked at the Sheriff Perry Hall Inmate Detention Facility in Bunnell and was released after posting $100,000 bail. Authorities said Cavallaro invited 2 women, employees of a local cafe, to his home, where he served them a drink he had poured out of a V8 container. Deputies said he told the women that the drink was a homemade rum runner. Deputies said the incident occurred December 17, 2017. One of the women told detectives she remembered consuming a mixed drink that Cavallaro had served to her and then falling down soon thereafter. She woke up later that evening lying naked in Cavallaro's bed while he performed oral sex on her. The accuser's husband also was interviewed by detectives. He told them that he drove to Cavallaro's home that night after he tried contacting his wife on her cell phone. Each time he dialed her number, the call was declined. According to an arrest report, the accuser's husband saw his wife's vehicle parked on Cavallaro's property. So he walked into the backyard, assuming she was there drinking. He didn't see anyone outside, but noticed a door to the house was open, so he walked inside. He came upon Cavallaro, who jumped up from under the covers of a bed, wearing only a pair of unzipped blue jeans. A moment later, the man's wife, who was naked, sat up. The husband told detectives he took Cavallaro to the ground before he could process what he had just witnessed. He assumed he had interrupted a consensual affair, so he let go of Cavallaro and left the house. However, the husband realized something was wrong later, after his wife came home. She was extremely intoxicated, so much so that she needed to be hospitalized. Eventually, the sheriff's office was contacted. Here again is George Ristakopoulos.
She reached out to the patrol, our patrol division, I believe it was 2 days later, and they took a report, and then she got some, she requested some assistance from our family life center and the sheriff's office, and then our investigation began essentially that day.
In January, detectives listened in on a controlled call between the accuser and Cavallaro. The arrest report stated that during the conversation, the woman brought up the sex act she said Cavallaro performed on her, and he didn't deny it. During the conversation, the accuser became so distraught she had to get up and leave. Detectives spoke with Cavallaro weeks later, and he denied having any sexual contact with the woman. He told them he had no interest in having sex with someone who was, quote, out of it.
It's always terrible to see somebody take advantage of somebody that they know. Unfortunately, a large majority of the cases that we work, especially of a sexual nature, they tend to involve somebody well known to the victim, as opposed to just somebody breaking into the house and something that you might see in a movie. That doesn't normally happen. It is typically somebody that they know.
Cavallaro has been written about a number of times in the News Journal due to his business dealings. In 2009, Cavallaro's development company sold some land to the city of Deltona so it could build a new fire station. The cost was $7.6 million, which critics thought was too high. Future offers made by Cavallaro with the city were rejected, in large part to how much he charged for the fire station property. Cavallaro, who was charged with one count of sexual battery, a first-degree felony, is scheduled to be arraigned July 29th. Coming up, the story of the mysterious disappearance of a grandmother and her 10-year-old grandson 18 years ago in Deltona. A few years after they vanished, investigators said they were murdered by the same man who went on a killing spree across two states.
Yeah, I think the most compelling part of this case, you know, the reason people were fascinated by it is sort of the mystery of it. From the minute that police arrived at that home in Deltona on May 12th, 2001, they came upon clues and interviews that sent them kind of all over the place.
That was Mark Harper, politics editor for the News Journal. He's written many stories about this case. It took 3 years before detectives closed the case, and it was only after the killer had murdered three more people during a rampage that started in Lake Helen and ended in the Blue Ridge Mountains in the southwest corner of North Carolina. During the morning of May 2, 2004, William Rick Bowes, a 53-year-old man from Lake Helen, lay along a grassy shoulder of Interstate 4. He had been shot to death. His wife, Deborah Bowes, was kidnapped by the killer and driven to Franklin, North Carolina, where she was subjected to the horrors of being held hostage by a coked-up maniac who was both homicidal and suicidal. That maniac was Douglas McClymont, who wound up kidnapping a second woman, his estranged wife, and killing a man and a woman inside their home in Franklin. A four-year-old girl who was inside the couple's house was not harmed. McClymont decided to let her live. But that didn't mean McClymont was the type who spared the lives of children. When he made up his mind to kill, he did so without any compunction at all. In the spring of 2001, 10-year-old Joshua Bryant and his 77-year-old grandmother, Lillian Martin, were reported missing. Investigators had suspected McClymont not long after the case got started. His name remained in the file during the next 3 years. The case concluded with McClymont being declared the killer of both Lillian and Joshua. Josh's older sister, Joanne Miller, had come home from a charity event the morning of May 12th and discovered her dresser drawers had been dumped in one of the bedrooms of her house. Then she noticed Josh and Lillian were missing. She called 911 to report someone had broken into her home. Joanne was 28 years old at the time, about 18 years older than her younger brother. She lived with her husband and her 2-year-old son in their house on West Seagate Drive in Deltona. Lillian and Josh also lived there. They stayed in the mother-in-law suite. Joanne had left that morning with her son to take part in a charity run for breast cancer at the Daytona International Speedway. They had left early, around 7 a.m. It was a Saturday. Joanne's husband, a retail manager, had left for work around the same time. The only people at home were Lillian and Josh. Joshua began living with his big sister after their mother died about a year earlier. Lillian also moved in, so the family was all together. Lillian would watch Josh while Joanne and her husband were at work. Joanne and her family lived in a 2-story home within walking distance of Deltona High School and a short distance from Howland Boulevard, one of the main drags through Deltona. The house also was close to Interstate 4, the east-west corridor that cuts through central Florida and stretches from Tampa to Daytona Beach. Joanne said her house had been burglarized, but detectives with the Volusia County Sheriff's Office told the media they found no other obvious signs that the house had been broken into other than the turned-over drawers. Additionally, nothing had been stolen. Word of the missing person spread far. The night after the pair's disappearance, more than 130 people met up for an impromptu search effort. Flyers went up. Joanne, who was a teacher, was surrounded by family and friends who were there to support her during her grief. Bloodhounds were used, and so were helicopters. Detectives interviewed Joanne and her husband, John Miller, for hours. The Volusia County Sheriff's Office said the case was unique to any others it had handled. The abduction was swift, and the victims left everything behind. Lillian's vehicle, money, and credit cards remained in the house. Her Ford Tempo was still in the driveway. The garage door was open. That often was the case when Joshua took his bicycle out, but the bike was still in the garage, along with everything else the boy owned. The television in Lillian's room was still on when Joanne got home. Sergeant A.J. Paglieri is a sergeant with the Volusia County Sheriff's Office. He's a supervisor in the major case unit.
When law enforcement arrived at the residence there on Seagate, 1046 West Seagate in Deltona, one of the things that stood out, other than a bedroom in the main part of the house, it seemed like there was nothing else that had really been disturbed. Josh and Lillian stayed in a separate part of the house that was kind of not in the main component of the house. My understanding is that Lillian had talked to her sister that morning, was talking about folding laundry, and was supposed to go over and visit the sister. And of course, by the time Joanne got there, there was no signs of Josh or Lillian. And then that's when, obviously, the investigation began. But why was this one bedroom? Why did it look like it had been disturbed? And other things in the house didn't look like the typical type of burglary that you would see normally.
There was no ransom note, There were no clues found in the woods around the home. Neighbors saw nothing. The last time anyone saw Lillian was around 7 a.m. that morning, when Joanne and her husband left the house. The last time anyone heard from Lillian was around 9 a.m., when she talked to her sister over the phone. The story about the missing woman and her 10-year-old grandson grabbed front-page headlines for weeks. It was big news in Orlando and Daytona Beach. A few days after the pair's disappearance, Joanne Miller made a public plea as she stood on her front lawn with her husband at her side. While struggling to keep her emotions in check, she spoke like she was talking directly to the person or persons who took them. She said, quote, "If you have them, please just bring them back safely. Drop them off somewhere in the road. We want them back so bad. I'm begging you, if you have any heart, please bring them back to me." By then, six agents from the FBI office in Jacksonville showed up to assist in the investigation. Some findings also got passed along to an FBI profiler. A segment on the show America's Most Wanted was devoted to the case. All of those extra resources didn't help. The sheriff at the time all but admitted to reporters that detectives weren't close to finding out what had happened. A captain with the sheriff's office at the time, the one who commanded the agency's major case unit, told the media, quote, "It's very safe to say this is the most puzzling of any of the cases we've had. I can sit here in 2 hours and convince you without a doubt that they're dead. I can turn around in the next 2 hours and convince you that they left on their own with information we've got." The unique aspect of the case was that investigators didn't know whether to call it a homicide, a missing persons case, or a kidnapping. There was no blood anywhere and nothing left behind by the suspect or suspects. They didn't even know whether anyone else was involved. The theory that Lillian took Joshua and left without word couldn't be rejected at that point. In fact, one prominent investigator was convinced that's what happened. Here is Alicia Caldwell, who covered the case while a reporter in the Volusia County Bureau of the Orlando Sentinel.
You know, there was a Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigator I spoke with at one point, wrote a story about, he said, you know, based on the evidence, these two walked away and they're perhaps living happily someplace else, but we may never know for sure, but he was confident that they walked away. And he said, and I think I quoted him at the time, you know, "I could be the hero or I could be the zero, but this is what all the evidence says." And obviously he was wrong.
Paglieri, who was not involved in the investigation and not with the sheriff's office in 2001, but was the only one from the sheriff's office willing to talk to me on the record about this case, said there were people closely involved with the investigation who suspected murder and others who felt Lillian probably orchestrated her and her grandson's disappearance.
There were two schools of thought. There was the school of thought of, did Lillian and Josh just leave on their own accord? And is that feasible? Or because of this bedroom, because of somewhat what the scene had shown inside the house, should we be suspicious of foul play?
Caldwell, who acknowledged that she has the benefit of hindsight, told me that it shouldn't have been seriously considered that a 77-year-old woman, regardless of what her perceived relationship was like with her granddaughter, would take a 10-year-old boy away from his legal guardian and vanish without telling even the closest people in her life. It wasn't even like her to leave the house without finishing all the chores she had in front of her.
Reading back through the story as I did this week, it seemed odd from the word go, right? Like, the laundry is half folded, the house is a little disheveled. That wasn't Lillian's MO. She wouldn't have left those things normally. I think she had talked to her sister earlier in the day and they had a pretty good relationship, and the sister felt, you know, if Lillian was going to pack up and move with Joshua, she would have told her.
Deltona, back then, as it is now, was the most populated city in Volusia County. It's considered a suburb of Orlando, and it's located along the I-4 corridor. The city occupies 46 square miles, including 8.5 square miles of lakes. Any search of a missing person that takes place there, and there have been more than one, requires combing over a massive area of land. For Furthermore, during the early to mid-2000s, Deltona was the place for a series of high-profile murder cases. Two, in particular, generated a lot of media attention. I profiled them both on this podcast. There was the October 2002 double murder at the Dollar General store in Deltona Plaza. Perhaps the worst of them all was the August 2004 massacre on Telford Lane, where six people were stabbed and bludgeoned inside a home. That case is still commonly referred to as the Xbox murders. The disappearances of Lillian Martin and Joshua Bryant predated both sets of slayings. If you put them all together, it's easy to conclude that those crimes forever altered the reputation of the city of Deltona. Here is A.J. Pagliari talking about how great of an impact the Martin Bryant case had on the area.
You go from nothing ever happening in a small little bedroom community like Deltona to realize that something, that an older woman, a grandmother, and her 10-year-old grandson can just, in a sense, vanish without a trace, with not many leads. Deltona is not the kind of place, and Volusia County in general is usually not the kind of place where something of that magnitude occurs. So Volusia has always been a very safe community, quiet community, a place where people come to get away from Orlando. And then when you live in Deltona, you get away from some of the hustle and bustle of Daytona Beach, and it's just a place where it's a bedroom community. And when you have something that kind of infiltrates where you have an elderly woman and a young boy just all of a sudden disappear, and there's just not many answers as to why or how, yeah, that's going to send some kind of fear.
Many of the news stories during the first few weeks of the Martin and Bryant case included details about Josh's deceased mother, Diane Bryant, who had a history of drug abuse and prostitution. She had died during a seizure about a year before her mother and son went missing. Joanne, who also was Bryant's daughter, became Josh's guardian. Joanne had some tense moments with investigators.
So when you have an investigation of this kind of magnitude, you have to look at everybody in terms of background information at the very least. And sometimes you have to ask uncomfortable questions. So while I can't say how Joanne or John might have felt, there was probably some questions that were asked. But again, they're going to have to ask some hard-pressing questions because when people just go missing, you're going to have to ask those things, because maybe somewhere in there they'll give a response to a question that might have nothing to do with what they think is important, but it might play a role as to what we saw on the scene.
Joanne had always maintained she was close to her grandmother and brother, but there were rumors about relations at the Miller home being less than harmonious. Detectives were aware of those rumors, too.
There were dueling theories that there was some tension there. You know, Joshua was the younger brother to Mrs. Miller, and obviously Lillian was grandmother to both. They had had not the easiest of lives up until this point, which is why Josh ended up living with his sister and brother-in-law along with their grandmother. So there were some dueling theories of she was ready to move, they were ready to have her, and Josh moved. She maintained, you know, through everything that she loved her brother and her grandmother, and, you know, was as devastated as anyone when they vanished. And then, you know, when Josh's remains were found, I'm sure it couldn't have been easy.
Lillian Martin was a widow and a retired bookkeeper. She had a major role in raising her grandchildren because her daughter, Diane, was so bogged down with drug abuse and run-ins with the law. Diane had four children, and Lillian wound up assuming the responsibility of raising all four. Among the four children she raised was Arnold Bryant, Joanne's sister. Arnold also had his share of problems, legal ones, and he didn't do his sister any favors when authorities interviewed him. One of the investigators spoke to Arnold after he had arrived at the scene the morning of Lillian and Josh's disappearance. Arnold decided he would try to give the sheriff's office some insight on the criminal mind. He was adamant that the crime scene didn't resemble a typical burglary. he started referring to his own criminal experiences to support that claim. One of the investigators asked him point blank, quote, "Where would you look if you were me?" Arnold answered, quote, "I'd start right in the home." As he said that, Arnold nodded his head toward Joanne and her husband, who were standing outside their neighbor's home. Among the throngs of reporters who covered this story was Mark Harper. And here is Mark talking to me a little bit more about Arnold Bryant.
You know, you have within her own family, this brother sort of giving the sheriff's office a reason to, you know, to be a little more skeptical of the family members inside the home. But, you know, there were a whole bunch of other clues and tips that led them elsewhere.
In spite of what little they had in terms of evidence, detectives did come up with a few names of possible suspects. They vetted each one. Among those who stood out was a 34-year-old unemployed laborer from DeLand by the name of Douglas McClymont. His criminal history dated back to 1985, when he was charged in an armed break-in at the age of 18. Soon before Lillian and Joshua disappeared, McClymont had been at Joanne Miller's house.
You know, interestingly, though, Doug McClymont did work at the Miller house. He was a handyman of sorts. He was an electrician. He had done some work. So this wasn't an unconnected, random individual in the broadest sense.
Someone known to McClymont tipped off investigators about that fact. Here again is A.J. Paglieri.
McClymont got interviewed early on in the investigation because there was some information that came in that from someone that he knew that maybe he had something to do with it. So he was interviewed and he provided an alibi.
But that alibi wasn't exactly ironclad. At the time, it was just enough to ward off the sniffing dogs. But Caldwell isn't so sure it should have been.
They had previously spoken to him as well in the immediate aftermath of Lillian and Joshua's disappearance, and he was never quite ruled out, but never quite ruled in as a suspect. He had an alibi at the time of their disappearance that he was smoking crack in the woods with his friends, which his friends backed up. Years later, obviously, you know, post his death, his friends were like, or at least one of them said, "Oh yeah, no, we made that up," or something to that end. Which, you know, at the time in 2004, there was a lot of pressing at the sheriff's office of how is smoking crack in the woods with your friends a viable defense or alibi? And, you know, it's always easy to second guess. I'm not fully aware of everything they did to either rule him in or rule him out at the time, but it certainly was like, in hindsight, holy molasses, this is peculiar that his alibi was that he was committing a different crime in the woods near the spot where a witness said she saw Josh walking into the woods with a gentleman, or a man. So it all raised lots of suspicions at the time. But again, that's the benefit of hindsight for me.
There was one sighting that investigators paid close attention to. Someone living in Casadega, an unincorporated community in West Volusia County, a few miles from Deltona, saw something near a woodline that aroused suspicion.
There was supposedly a sighting of a man with a beard and a boy over in the Casadega area at the time, which would have been within the time frame of when Josh and Lillian went missing.
The woman told the sheriff's office she had seen a man and a boy walking in the woods behind her home, and that sighting was during a crucial time, not long after Lillian and Joshua were reported missing. The man was seen carrying duct tape. For 3 years, this case went cold. McClymont, for the most part, remained off the radar. He got married, but he didn't stay married for long. His wife began to fear him. Then she left him. What happened the morning of May 2nd, 2004, was horrifying. Rick Bowes was found along the grassy shoulder of I-4 in the area of Lake Helen, a small town southeast of DeLand, and a short drive from Deltona. Authorities did not learn that Bowes was the deceased man they had found until the following morning. 16 hours or so after Douglas McClymont had shot and killed him. After the shooting, he had driven to Beau's house, kidnapped his wife, and then traveled 600 miles north to kill two more people and abduct another. Beau's was a plumber, and he knew McClymont. Around 7 a.m. on May 2, 2004, Beau's drove his SUV to a convenience store to get some coffee. He did that mostly every morning. That's where he encountered McClymont. Authorities never fully understood why McClymont targeted Beau's that morning.
That's unclear, other than a car, like he needed a car to get to North Carolina is the presumption. He was chasing his estranged wife. They'd been married for maybe a year or so, and the way she described it in the stories I wrote, having looked back at him, is that he changed. He started to use alcohol and drugs and became a different person. So she left, sought refuge with, I believe, friends in North Carolina. He's an older couple. So the prevailing theory is that on that Sunday morning, the Climont was setting out to try to get to North Carolina. He had, I think he'd had some issues with his mom and her car and didn't have a way to get up there.
Investigators said the men traveled in Beau's vehicle from the convenience store to a wooded area along I-4. A witness who drove by said he saw McClymont standing outside the 2002 Chevrolet Tahoe with a gun. He fired into the vehicle. That witness called 911 around 7:30 a.m. If that wasn't enough, McClymont drove the Tahoe near Beau's home, entered the house through the kitchen, and came face-to-face with Beau's wife, Deborah. Here again is Alicia Caldwell.
She thought the person coming into the house was her husband. And sort of suddenly it was like, hey, you're not my husband, tries to run. As he had apparently told her, you know, over the course of time, like, hey, if anybody breaks into the house, you run. You run into the woods, you hide, you know, whatever. So that was her goal, and she did not make it. As she described, you know, obviously I didn't get far. McClymont then kidnaps her, and en route to North Carolina, begins to tell her how he's killed at least two other people, and, you know, that he, everything will be fine if she does what he says, and she's going to be able to live to tell his story.
McClymont bound Deborah Beau's and forced her into the cab of her Dodge pickup. Authorities later said that McClymont dumped the Tahoe because one of the windows had been shot out of it, and that's why he couldn't drive it to North Carolina. He needed another vehicle, so he went to a place he knew he could find one. He had possession of Rick Beau's keys, so he knew he could enter the house. It isn't known whether he went to that house specifically to kidnap Deborah. But once he sped away in Deborah's truck, he headed north to get his wife, Teresa Lynn Martinez. He found out where Martinez was. She was staying at her friend's home in Franklin, a small town located in the center of the Nantahala National Forest. It's located between Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Charlotte, North Carolina. When he showed up at the home of James and Joanne Manny, he wasted no time killing them both and then kidnapping Martinez. James Manny was 59. Joanne was 60. The four-year-old child that was inside the house was unharmed. She was the Manny's great-grandchild. According to one of the stories Caldwell wrote about the shootings, Franklin police showed up at the house after getting a call about a possible domestic disturbance. They found no evidence of a disturbance, so they left to respond to another call. That was about 10 o'clock at night. They returned close to midnight and heard a child crying inside. They forced their way inside and found the slain victims. Deputies in neighboring Cherokee County tried to pull over the Dodge pickup that McClymont was driving for an apparent traffic violation. McClymont did not pull over. Authorities laid down stop sticks across a highway in Murphy, located in the far southwest corner of North Carolina. The tires were punctured, but McClymont kept driving several more miles. It crashed after he shot himself in the head. He did so in front of his wife and Deborah Beau's. He used the very same .38 caliber revolver he had used to kill William Bowes and James and Joanne Maney. Authorities said Deborah Bowes didn't learn about the fate of her husband until after McClymont had killed himself. She suspected McClymont had killed Rick, but he insisted he hadn't. Here is Mark Harper talking to me about Doug McClymont and how challenging it was to get anyone who knew him to divulge any information about him.
Well, you know, he had a, you know, like I said, he had a long record of arrests and criminal charges, drugs, domestic violence, divorces, and, you know, wives seeking injunctions to keep him from them. You know, what seems clear, I guess, all these years later is just McClymont was a dangerous criminal with a drug habit. He contributed to a lot of bad things that went down in Deltona and Lake Helen and elsewhere in West Volusia and you know, later on in North Carolina. But, you know, when we try to report on him after his final crime spree and sort of when, you know, we knew that he was the suspect in the missing grandma and boy story, people were uncomfortable talking to us about him. You know, some people, you know, didn't want to be associated with him, and others didn't want to inflict further pain on his own family. It was a challenging story to get people to talk about, you know, any of it on all sides, it seemed.
Some more information did trickle in about McClymont and his last days. Not long before his rampage, deputies and local police were on the lookout for him. McClymont's mother had accused him of stealing $3,500 from her. It was rumored that he was holed up in an Orange City motel room using drugs that he had bought with the stolen money. All of the hotels in the area of Orange City were checked, but he wasn't found. Authorities did not catch up to him until he shot himself. McClymont actually remained alive for a while after that bullet to the head, but he died of his injuries in a hospital bed in Chattanooga. Alicia Caldwell managed to contact McClymont's estranged wife in Franklin. She said McClymont married her in February 2003, a mere 15 months before his death. It wasn't long after they got married that his behavior started to change. She told Caldwell he was possessive, controlling, and he was out of control. She had told him to move out of their Franklin home in early 2004. He had been mentally ill and was abusing drugs. Martinez declined to tell Alicia any details of what he did to her after he kidnapped her. Deborah Bowes declined to talk to the media about her ordeal, but she did eventually talk to detectives after they gave her time to recuperate and mourn the death of her husband. During her interview, she described how she lay bound with duct tape in the truck's extended cab while McClymont drove. He insisted to her that he had not killed her husband, but warned her that he had killed other people in his past, and he was on his way to add to the total. During the long drive to Franklin, McClymont made a few stops. He stopped for gas and also to buy crack cocaine. During a stop at Walmart in Georgia, he bought ammunition, duct tape, and more supplies. Deborah remained in a lying down position almost the entire trip. McClymont ordered her to do that so that passing motorists couldn't see her. A few times he unbound her and then bound her again. At one point, when he was close to his destination, he placed a strip of tape over her mouth. He told her he was hellbent on finding his wife and then killing some drug dealers. Police said the Maneys, the couple he wound up killing, had no connection to any drugs. It took about a month before the sheriff's office went public with their suspicions about McClymont in regards to the Martin Bryant disappearance. But as soon as detectives found out that McClymont was responsible for the death of Rick Bowes and the couple in Franklin, they went back through some of his old files and decided to retrace their steps. Here again is A.J. Pagliari.
They recognized the name and they said, Doug McClymont. And then they said, well, Doug McClymont's name came up in the Josh and Lillian thing. And so due to some some good police work. Those guys went back through the case file, the Josh and Lillian case file, looked for some leads. They had saw some similarities in terms of Doug having uniquely colored van. They went back and talked to some of those individuals who had said, hey, this is where we saw the child and Doug in the woods. And then they just, again, by some sheer luck and good police work, they went down to that same area. And two detectives, I can recall hearing the story. The two detectives went out to the woods, just went in for a little while, started looking around, and came across a skeleton that turned out to be Joshua Bryan.
Alicia Caldwell began catching on to McClymont's involvement long before the sheriff's office announced anything. She noticed something about McClymont's mugshot when it was released. It conjured something in her photographic memory. Caldwell also was following the story of missing fisherman Lee Abel, who was 78 years old when he disappeared while fishing at Canaveral National Seashore near New Smyrna Beach in the southeast sector of Volusia County, a short distance from Brevard County. His wife reported him missing December 20th, 2001, 7 months after Lillian and Josh were declared missing. Abel lived with his wife in Orange City in West Volusia. His vehicle was found abandoned in Boca Raton in late 2002. 10 years later, Abel's remains were found all the way in St. Johns County, near St. Augustine, two counties north of Volusia. The mystery surrounding Abel's death has never been solved. But in that case, just like in the Martin Bryant case, there was a composite sketch drawn of someone suspicious spotted in the vicinity of where Abel had last been seen. Those sketches looked nearly identical. Not only that, but both sketches looked an awful lot like McClymont's mugshot. Here again is Alicia Caldwell.
When I got this story, you know, I took over the police beat in Volusia County. There were lots of files on this case, Joshua and Lillian, as well as a missing fisherman from around the same era, a guy named Lee Abel. And in both of those cases, there were composite drawings. And I had written about both of those cases in the intervening periods before Joshua's remains were found. And when Doug McClymont's mugshot was released post May 2004 rampage or murder spree, his photo just looked really familiar to me. And I thought, well, how the heck would I know this guy? And I dug through my files and found the two composites and put them out in an array for myself on the desk and just thought, these are the same guy. There's no way that they're not. Either he, you know, was previously the unluckiest human to be drawn as a composite sketch in two different missing persons cases, or he's somehow involved, or at least witnesses believe him to be involved. So I started down that path. I showed the photos to my editor, and he agreed, and we went from there and just started digging, including talking to Mrs. Abel, who had been approached by the Volusia County Sheriff's Office in the wake of all of this, because obviously they saw the same things I did. It's not like I'm the smartest woman in the room, right?
On June 7th, 2004, 1 month after Rick Bowes was killed, the Volusia County Sheriff's Office announced it had found the bones of Joshua Bryant and linked his murder to McClymont. Here again is A.J. Paglieri.
Well, the remains of Lillian have never been found. So specifically how she was killed, I don't have any knowledge on that. But what I do know about Josh, and again, coming from the detective, the case agent on at the time, is that it appeared that Josh had been killed with some kind of edged weapon.
Edged weapon, like a blade?
Yeah. Yep. He had sustained some trauma, to the skeleton, because again, that's all that was remaining was the skeleton at the time, and there were signs on Josh's skeleton that he had been that had some kind of sharp-edged weapon. I'm not certain on the specifics on what it was, but a sharp-edged weapon was used in his death.
What was hard to ignore about the discovery of Josh's remains was that it appeared no effort was made to conceal his body after it was dumped in the woods. There are a couple theories about that.
This witness that saw what they believed, well, actually what turned out to be Doug McClymont, they kind of looked at each other. This witness saw Doug, Doug saw the witness, and then you just kind of, it was like they tried to conceal themselves. Doug tried to conceal himself. And at the same time that was happening, we were able to figure out that our airship, the Air One helicopter, was coming over to assist in the search in 01 of the residents or the area over in Deltona. And we believe that the reason why Josh was found in the condition he was found in 04, which was above surface, is that McClymont got spooked because of, again, seeing this witness and perhaps the helicopter's in the air, and so then decided to forego whatever his plan would have been. And then, of course, Josh remained there from May of 01 until he was subsequently found in June of 04.
That witness who saw a man in the woods near her home with a roll of duct tape and accompanied by a boy would confirm to detectives 3 years later that McClymont was the man she saw. She confirmed it via a photo lineup. She did not think, however, that the boy looked anything like Josh. Perhaps that's why that lead wasn't pursued like it should have been. Perhaps that's why detectives in 2001 didn't push harder and question McClymont's alibi. Either way, McClymont did not get arrested in 2001. After that, he got married, got estranged, went on a cocaine bender, and killed three people, and traumatized two women and a four-year-old girl. One of the investigators actually went back to the person who claimed to have been with McClymont the morning of the disappearance of Lillian and Josh. That person admitted to the detective that the alibi was a lie. Another witness had also told investigators that he saw McClymont later on that day, on May 12, 2001. He said McClymont was in a frenzied state and his legs were scratched and bloody, like he had been roaming through some thick woods. Another casualty in all of this was Joanne Miller, whose reputation was damaged in the wake of the disappearance of her brother and grandmother. She seemed to have been scarred emotionally by the entire experience. She and her husband left Deltona. She spoke only briefly to Mark Harper in 2011. He wrote a comprehensive story about the 10-year anniversary of the Martin Bryant case. In that story, Joanne told my News Journal colleague, quote, "I've tried to move on as best I can." Referring to her grandmother, Joanne told Mark, quote, "She was like a mother and a best friend. She was my constant source of support and encouragement." Here is Mark Harper describing to me his brief interactions with Joanne Miller.
She and her husband had a brief press conference at their home with Chaney Mason about a week after the disappearance. Chaney Mason, the attorney who would later help get Casey Anthony an acquittal. She allowed the media to cover her brother's funeral when that happened, but you know, Joanne Miller, I think, largely avoided interviews and wanted to keep her family out of the media spotlight. Even at the 10-year retrospective, when I was trying to research, she didn't want to talk to me then. And, I can understand wanting to, keep your family out of the spotlight. Still, I think, a very painful memory. And it's a tough thing for her and for, her family, especially in part because of the suspicions that were raised about her and her family at the time.
In spite of the developments in the case in 2004, it did not appear as though the sheriff's office worked all that fast in clearing Joanne.
Even after Joshua's body had been recovered and McClymont had been identified as the killer, the sheriff's office still wouldn't sort of completely absolve the Millers and kind of clear them completely publicly, which I remember Chaney Mason said was, I remember the word, he used the word irritating.
Authorities also haven't made any headway in the Lee Abel case.
I don't know that all the questions will ever be answered, including, you know, what happened to Lee Abel. Again, it's an uncanny coincidence, if it's just a coincidence, that somebody who looked an awful lot like Doug McClymont was sketched in his disappearance. And Mrs. Abel kept, for whatever reason, and she said she wasn't quite sure herself, but it was just something that made her take, you know, newspaper clippings, Josh and Lillian, and then, you know, once the 2004 murder spree or killing spree occurred, you know, she kept those newspaper clippings too. And as I said, when I spoke to her, she told me that the sheriff's office had been out there and asked me about the sketch and if she knew McClymont. And as I recall, she did not. She didn't have any interaction with him. But, you know, it's as big a place as Volusia and Brevard counties are, and Brevard is where Mr. Abel went missing at the Canaveral National Seashore. They're also kind of small places. So it wouldn't have been unusual if they had seen him, but it also wouldn't have been unusual if they had.
I spoke last week with Sergeant Gene Tolbert with the St. Johns County Sheriff's Office. He is the lead investigator in the Lee Abel case. He told me he couldn't find any connection between McClymont and Abel, but just like in the Martin Bryant case, that name, Douglas McClymont, remains in the file, and the case remains open. McClymont has never been officially charged in the Martin Bryant case. There was talk about a grand jury being paneled, but that never happened. A sheriff's office spokesman told Mark Harper in 2011 that the case didn't have to go before a grand jury because, quote, we had unraveled the mystery and identified the killer. He added that the extra step of taking it to a grand jury seemed unnecessary. As to why Lillian and Josh were killed, investigators have their theories, but no definitive answers.
Well, I don't think anybody knows why. Climont was clearly had a serious drug problem and had, you know, some instances of violence in his past. He had a domestic violence complaint and some other kinds of incidents on his record prior to any of this. Just seemed like those answers as to what he was trying to accomplish in their home that day, you know, if it was a burglary gone wrong or something, those answers just aren't going to be, you know, we're just never going to know, probably.
Sergeant A.J. Paglieri, who was directly involved in another high-profile murder case in Deltona, in which the victims disappeared and were never seen again, knows how difficult it is for an investigator to cope with completing an investigation and still not have all of the looming questions answered. Motive isn't necessary to find someone guilty, but it's never a good feeling to have no concrete answers to the question, why did this person commit this murder?
When you have a person like Doug McClymont who goes and does what he did, he's got more answers. And he took those answers to the grave. And that's a frustrating part as a detective following up a case like this.
Thank you for listening. Tune in a few weeks when I will profile the case of George Trofimoff, the highest-ranking U.S. military officer ever convicted of espionage. He was arrested in 2000 in Tampa following an undercover sting conducted by the FBI. My special guest for that segment will be the former AP reporter who wrote about the case. I hope you'll join us then.
You can find Tony on Twitter at @TonyCrimeWriter or email him at tony.holt@news-jrnl.com. Be sure to rate us on iTunes. Sun Crime State is recorded by Tony Holt and produced by Chris Bridges for the Daytona Beach News Journal.